The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely those of the authors and participants, and do not necessarily represent those of iHeartMedia, Stuff Media, or its employees. Listener discretion is advised. From iHeartRadio and Tenderfoot TV, Monster presents Insomniac.
In late evening of September 5th, 1991, just hours before his scheduled execution, Donald Henry Gaskins, age 58, better known as Pee Wee Gaskins, was found bleeding in his holding cell. Gaskins had snuck in a razor blade by swallowing it, and then coughed it up to cut his wrists. It was either his last-ditch effort to stall the execution process, or to altogether rob the South Carolina authorities of their planned execution of the convicted killer. Either way, it didn't work. They stitched him up, bandaged his still leaking wrists, and led him to the electric chair, as scheduled. It was now the early morning hours of September 6th, 1991, just after midnight, and he had just minutes to live. Pee-wee was aptly named, but despite his diminutive size, he was something of a larger-than-life character, only not in the way anyone would ever admire. In fact, Pee-wee seemed to be rotten from the time he was a young boy, right up until the very minute he died. In addition to his crimes on the outside, and later, his crimes on the inside, one of which he would pay for with his own life, Pee-wee had somehow managed to pull off what was likely the most audacious death row killing of another inmate that the U.S. and maybe even the world had ever seen. Once you learn who Pee-wee was and how he lived his corrupt life, you'll think that he would have had something profound or even outrageous to say as he was strapped to the electric chair on that September evening. But the last words he ever said were simply, "I'll let my lawyer speak for me. I'm ready to go." And shortly after those words were uttered, the man who earned the nickname "the meanest man in America" was dead at 1:05 a.m. on September 6th, 1991. I'm Scott Benjamin, and everything I'm about to tell you is real. This is Insomniac. He was eventually called the meanest man in America, but he was also known as the Hitchhiker's Killer and the Redneck Charles Manson. Admittedly, he had a funny nickname for a grown man, Pee-wee. But let me assure you, there's absolutely nothing funny about the life and the seemingly endless crimes of this undersized criminal. When he was a fully grown man, Pee-wee stood just 5 feet 2 inches tall and weighed about 130 pounds. He had always been small for his age, and he clearly wasn't ever going to intimidate anybody with his size. But Pee-wee didn't need size to strike fear into the lives of those around him. He endured a lifetime of torment and pain, and he would return that pain and suffering to those unfortunate enough to cross his path. His criminal record spanned decades, and he more than earned the reputation as the meanest man in America. In the end, Pee-wee would claim he was responsible for more than 100 murders. Men, women, and even children among his victims. Yet he was convicted of just 9. And we say just because those crimes only begin to tell his story. Was the South Carolina native as violent as he claimed to be? Or was he just trying to inflate his image to be known as the most prolific serial killer to date? Many of these killings were never proven, of course. And maybe he was just bragging. But when he was alive, Pee-wee claimed to be one of the deadliest serial killers on record. And there was good reason to believe him. To begin, we have to travel to Florence County, South Carolina, on March 13, 1933, the day when a tiny, 4-pound baby boy named Donald Henry Parrott Jr. was born. Of the long list of illegitimate children born to his mother, Yulia Parrott, Donald Henry Parrott Jr. was the last. Not only was he the baby, but he was also the smallest of all of her children. Right from the beginning, Pee-wee earned his nickname among his siblings and friends for his small size. Growing up, he was always small for his age. To say that Pee-wee had a difficult childhood would be an understatement. The neglect was so severe, it was even rumored that Gaskins accidentally drank a bottle of kerosene as a child, which led to convulsions. Pee-wee would later tell others of the way he was neglected as a kid. Being born on a farm, I know the difference between raising something and it just growing. You raise tobacco and vegetables, pigs and sheep. They got purpose. You tend them. But weeds grow on their own, tended or not. I grew. I wasn't raised. That's for damn sure. He was always a poor student, didn't get along with the other kids, and he quit school at the age of 11. He took a job as a mechanic at the local garage, and he had always seemed to be mechanically inclined. He could fix almost anything. Toys, cars, appliances, electronics, you name it, he could repair it. When Gaskins was just 13 years old, he and two other boys from town, Danny and Marsh, formed a group called the Trouble Trio. The trio began burglarizing homes, raping young boys, and picking up prostitutes in nearby cities. As a part of this juvenile delinquent group, Pee-wee's first arrest came early, when he was just 13 years old. Having answered to Pee-wee his whole life, he first learned his real name when it was read aloud during this court appearance for a crime spree Gaskins committed with the Trouble Trio. At 13, Pee-wee was still too young for jail. He was confined in the South Carolina Industrial School, a reform school for boys, until he turned 18 years old. As you can imagine, it was not a good experience. While at the reform school, he was tormented and even gang-raped by as many as 20 other young inmates. From that point forward, he spent all of his time either accepting protection from the boss boy in exchange for sex or plotting his own escape. Pee-wee had grown so accustomed to being a target that all of this was nothing new to him. Due to his small size, Pee-wee was regularly the focus of attention from bullies and often found himself in a position of having to endure violence in school, just as he was now experiencing in the reform school. Pee-wee eventually did manage to escape the school, and while he was out, he got married to a 13-year-old girl and lived on the run for a while. This was the first of many marriages he would have, 6 in total over the years, but none of them knew about his other brides, and he would only ever divorce one of the women. Going on the advice of his current mother-in-law, Pee-wee soon returned, voluntarily, to complete his sentence at the reform school. After a sentence was completed in 1951, at 18 years old, Gaskins took a job at a local tobacco plantation. It wasn't long before he found a way to make additional money. He found a partner to conduct insurance fraud with, and they would work with tobacco farmers to burn their barns for a fee, collecting the insurance payout. By 1953, he was known as a barn burner, and people were on to him. Gaskins' employer's daughter and friend confronted Gaskins about his reputation as the barn burner, and he wasn't happy. In a rage, he hit her in the head with a hammer and split her skull. This led to a 6-year prison sentence at the South Carolina Central Correction Institution for assault with a deadly weapon and attempted murder. Upon arrival, similar to his time in reform school, Gaskins was attacked by the other inmates. He was raped and owned in prison by the older, bigger inmates. But in order to become a more powerful player while he was behind bars, Pee-wee knew that he had to make a change. In order to survive, he knew what he had to do. He had to kill somebody, in prison, to become what was known as a power man. Gaskins managed to manipulate himself into a relationship of trust with Hazel Brazell, the fiercest power man in the prison at the time. After gaining the man's trust, Gaskins cut his throat. It was the first time Pee-wee had ever killed, and it gave him a sensation unlike anything he had ever felt before. Pee-wee was found guilty of manslaughter, and he spent the next 6 months in solitary confinement. But he was now known as a power man among other prisoners. Things would be different for Pee-wee moving forward. For his crime, the killing of Brazell, Pee-wee would spend an extra 3 years in prison, but he got his wish. He was no longer a victim. He was now the top dog. He was the bully. As part of my research for this episode, I took the time to read Pee-wee Gaskins' memoirs, Final Truth, The Autobiography of a Serial Killer by Donald Gaskins and Wilton Earle. It's his life story, in his own words, and he doesn't hold back. He even reveals a few things he wouldn't tell the authorities while he was alive, out of fear for how he would have been treated in prison. Some of the things Pee-wee says in his book are far more graphic and harsh than just about anything I've ever read in my entire life. And as you can imagine, I've collected a lot of true crime books over the years. Pee-wee's descriptions of not only his many murders and violent attacks, but also the rape and torture of many women and men, and even one infant, are so descriptive that they've left an impression on me that will take more than a little while to forget. The only other true crime book I've ever read that even comes close to this level of brutality is a book that was written by another serial killer, Gerard John Schaefer, while he was in prison. That book was called Killer Fiction. The reason these two books stand out among others is simple. They're written by the killers themselves. When a man gets to a point where he can say anything he wants without the fear of prosecution or judgment by others, he can freely admit to anything and everything evil that he's done throughout his entire life. This can be read in one of two ways. It could be thought of as his final confession, or it could be a way for the killer to brag or boast about his crimes one final time while people are still paying attention to what he has to say. Pee-wee saw his book as a way to confess everything he'd ever done, and what he left behind is a stomach-churning, deeply disturbing piece of literature, if you can call it that, that will no doubt haunt you for a long time to come. Yes, there are detailed descriptions of murders and rapes in plenty of true crime books, and many of them are quite vivid, but very few can compare to the brutal descriptions found in Pee-wee's book. You would think that Pee-wee would have almost enjoyed the remainder of his time in prison. After all, he was now looked upon with some respect after having killed Hazel Brazell. However, in 1955, by hiding in the back of a garbage truck, Pee-wee was able to escape from prison, and he quickly fled to Florida. He avoided arrest by working with a traveling minister as his driver and general assistant. Eventually, he was discovered and arrested soon after. But he was once again paroled in August of 1961. As soon as Pee-wee got out of prison, now age 28, he immediately went back to his old ways of burglary, stealing, and fencing stolen property. There, he met another young woman. She was 17, and married for the fourth time. She found out he was on the run, and she eventually turned him into the police, who convicted Gaskins of the 12-year-old's rape. He received 6 years at the Columbia Penitentiary, and was eventually paroled in November 1968. Pee-wee was now 35 years old. Upon his release, Pee-wee moved to the town of Sumter, South Carolina, and took a job with a roofing company. He was a convicted murderer, but at this point, he had only killed in prison. Throughout Gaskins' life, He described feelings that forced him into criminal activity, which he referred to as them aggravated and bothersome feelings. In September of 1969, he found a way to get relief from those feelings. He became a killer once again. This was the first of what he would call his coastal kills, murders that he committed simply for his own pleasure. Gaskins picked up a female hitchhiker in North Carolina, and he became angry when she laughed at his sexual propositions. He beat her until she was unconscious. Gaskins then raped, sodomized, and tortured her. He took her to a swamp, weighed her body down, and sank her into the murky water. Later, he would recall that he enjoyed the feeling of power he had over her. She was helpless. He said, "All I could think about is how I could do anything I wanted to her. Anything." This was just the first of many, many victims that Pee-wee would leave in his wake. He drove around the American South, hiding the bodies as he went about his work. Gaskins took both women and men for his coastal kills, averaging a kill about every 6 weeks. All were murdered for his own gratification. Later, Pee-wee would claim his coastal kills were even more frequent, killing a person before the 10th of each month. He had finally discovered how to satisfy his urges, and from that point on, it was the driving force in his life. He worked on mastering his skill of torture, often keeping his mutilated victims alive for days. As time went on, his depraved mind grew darker, and he committed even more horrific crimes. He even ventured into cannibalism, eating the severed parts of his victims while forcing them to watch in horror. On occasion, forcing them to participate by eating their own flesh. That night, I've started to psych myself out about sleep, laying awake in the darkness, trying to force myself to rest when I know I'm supposed to. Sometimes I watch the clock as I count down the hours until I have to be up for work. If I get to sleep now, I'll get 4 hours of rest. If I get to sleep now, I'll have 3 hours of rest. And you know how the rest goes. I always feel like I'm in a mental fog, just sort of making it through the day in a zombie-like fashion. If these sleepless or nearly sleepless nights last for more than 3 or 4 evenings, the feeling I get is a sort of delirium. No hallucinations for me, not yet. But it's like my brain and the rest of my body don't want to work at the same speed. I have days when I have trouble speaking more than even a few words at a time, struggling to get through meetings and conversations with coworkers, having to apologize the entire day for my mistakes. All of this is embarrassing. I can't take operating like this for too much longer. Nighttime is supposed to be a time to replenish yourself, to sort out the day's events and clear your mind of any troubles, to recharge your batteries and get ready for the next day. Instead, it only seems to be adding to the problem. Or maybe it is the problem. I don't know. Throughout his life, Pee-wee Gaskins would operate his own chop shop for automobiles, a garage where stolen cars were brought to be either repainted and sold at auction out of state, or completely stripped and sold for parts. It's a lucrative business, completely illegal, of course, but profitable. In the year 1973, Pee-wee had the opportunity to buy an old hearse. It happened when one of Pee-wee's criminal associates drove up one day in the old stolen car, looking to get rid of it as soon as possible. Pee-wee couldn't resist, and he bought the car for his own personal transportation. And while driving a hearse might sound like an unusual choice for anyone, a lot of people simply have an interest in that type of vehicle. For one, they're all custom built. They aren't mass produced, so each example is a one of a kind in some way or another. They're also typically beautiful in design, inside and out, because they're created from top-end luxury cars like Cadillac, Lincoln, Mercedes-Benz, or even Rolls-Royce. Another point is that they're unusual, interesting, and, well, simply different. So they have some appeal to certain car enthusiasts too, not just those in the funeral industry or the occasional serial killer. Pee-wee, on the other hand, viewed owning a hearse as an opportunity. He could use it for its intended purpose and do it right under the noses of the authorities. Pee-wee was flippant with his friends and even the local police about what he was up to. For instance, when asked about the hearse while sitting at his favorite bar, he would say he needed the vehicle to haul all the people he killed to his own private cemetery. Everyone would laugh it off as if it was a good joke, and then go back to drinking or whatever they were up to. But the reality was that Pee-wee was using the vehicle for exactly that purpose, hauling the dead bodies of his victims to his own private cemetery, some out-of-the-way property he owned in Prospect, South Carolina. Pee-wee felt that if the authorities would laugh and joke with him about the hearse and its use, they weren't concerned about him as a suspect, and he could hide in plain sight. He even had a sign in the back window that said, "We haul anything, living or dead." Pee-wee's level of violence was escalating, and he even created his own new category of murders, one that he kept entirely separate from his random coastal kills. There was a twist to the story, too, a single murder that will cost Pee-wee his own life in the end. The same murder that was thought impossible by everyone, and the reason he was known as the meanest man in America. Next time on Insomniac.
Insomniac is a production of iHeartRadio and Tenderfoot TV. Written and hosted by Scott Benjamin and produced by Miranda Hawkins, Alex Williams, Matt Frederick, and Josh Thane. Music composed by Makeup and Vanity Set and cover art by Trevor Eiler. Follow on Twitter and Facebook at Insomniac Pod, on Instagram at Insomniac Podcast, and at our website, insomniacpodcast.com. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.